No sympathy, no support, no concern, because the press didn't project it in such a way that it would be designed to get your sympathy. They know how to put something so that you'll sympathize with it, and they know how to put it so you'll be against it. I'm telling you, they are masters at it. And if you don't develop the... And they know how to put it so you'll be against it. I'm telling you, they are masters at it. And if you don't develop the analytical ability to read between the lines in what they're saying, I'm telling you again, they'd be building that gas ovens. And before you wake up, you'll be in one of them, just like the Jews ended up in gas ovens over there in Germany. You're in a society that's just as capable of building gas ovens for black people as Hitler's society was. This was mass murder in the Congo of women and children and babies. But there was no outcry even from the white liberals, even from your friends. Why? Because they made it appear that it was a humanitarian project. They said that the planes were being flown by American-trained anti-Castro Cuban pilots. This is propaganda too. As soon as you hear that it's American-trained, you say, oh, that's all right, that's us. And the anti-Castro Cubans, oh, that's all right too, because if they're against Castro, whoever else they're against, that's good, because Castro's a monster. But you see how step by step they grab your mind? And these pilots are hired. Their salaries are paid by the United States government. They're called mercenaries, these pilots are. And a mercenary is not someone who kills you because he's patriotic. He kills you for blood money. He's a hired killer. That's what a mercenary means. And they're able to take these hired killers, put them in American planes with American bombs, and drop them on African villages, blowing to bits black men, black women, flown by American-trained anti-Castro Cuban pilots. This is propaganda, too. As soon as you hear that it's American-trained, you say, oh, that's all right, that's us. And the anti-Castro Cubans, oh, that's all right, too, because if they're against Castro, whoever else they're against, that's good, because Castro's a monster. But you see how step by step they grab your mind? And these pilots are hired. Their salaries are paid by the United States government. They're called mercenaries, these pilots are. And a mercenary is not someone who kills you because he's patriotic. He kills you for blood money. He's a hired killer. That's what a mercenary means. And they're able to take these hired killers, put them in American planes with American bombs, and drop them on African villages, blowing to bits black men, black women, black children, black babies, and you black people sitting over here cool like it doesn't even involve you. You're a fool. They'll do it to them today and do it to you tomorrow. Because you and I and they are all the same. They call it a humanitarian project, and that they're doing it in the name of freedom. And all of this, these glorious terms are used to pave the way in your mind for what they're going to do. Then they take Shombi. You heard of Shombi. He's the worst African that was ever born. The lowest type that was ever born. He's a murderer himself. He's the murderer of Lumumba, the former prime minister of the Kinshasa prime minister of the Congo. He's an international, he's a murderer with an international stature as a murderer. Yet the United States government went and got Shombi in Spain and put him as the head of the Congolese government. Imagine that. This is criminal. Here's a man who's a murderer. So the United States takes him, puts him over the Congo, and supports his government with your tax dollars. Now, in other words, they hire him to occupy the position as head of state over the Congo. A killer. He is a hired killer himself. His salary paid by the United States government. And he turns, his first move is to bring in South Africans who hate everything in sight. He hires those South Africans to come and kill his own Congolese people. And the United States, again, pays their salary. You know, it's something to think about. How do you think you would feel right now if some Congolese brothers walked up to you, they look just like you. Don't think you don't look Congolese. You look as much Congolese as the Congolese do. They got all kinds of Congolese over there. How would you feel if one of them walked up to you and asked you about what your government is doing in the Congo? I was asked that when I was over there. But they didn't have to come to me like that because they know where I stand automatically anyway. And for which I'm thankful to the press for letting everybody know where I stand. But you have no explanation. Your tongue stays in your mouth. And you have to then go to the extreme to convince them that you don't go along with what the United States government is doing in the Congo. But again, your image making comes into importance here. And they justify the usage of Tshombe as the present head of state by saying he's the only African who can unite or bring unity to the Congo. Has he brought unity to the Congo? But see, this is their game. And their real reason for wanting Tshombe there was so that Tshombe could invite them to come in. No other African head of state would have dared to invite outside powers. So they put Tshombe there. And as soon as Tshombe got there, then he invited them to bring paratroopers from Belgium in the United States transport planes to try and recapture the Congo. This is all a cold-blooded act on the part of your Western powers, namely the Western powers here in the United States, the interests in the United States, in England, in France, and in Belgium, and so forth. They want the wealth of the Congo, plus its strategic geographic position. The step-by-step process that was used by the press, first they fanned the flame in such a manner to create hysteria in the mind of the public, and then they shift gears and fanned the flame in a manner designed to get the sympathy of the public. And once they go from hysteria to sympathy, their next step is to get the public to support them in whatever act they're getting ready to go down with. You're dealing with a cold, calculating international machine that's so criminal in its objectives and motives that it has the seeds of its own destruction right within it. They use the press to emphasize that white hostages are being held by cannibals. Imagine that. White priests, white missionaries, white nuns. They don't say nuns. White nuns. You know what the paper said right here in Detroit. White missionary, not just a missionary, a white nun, as if there's a difference between a white nun and a black nun, or a white priest and a black priest, or if the life that's in a white skin is more valuable than a life within a black skin. This is what they're implying. And the press, go get the press when this thing was going on, and you see what I'm talking about. They're vicious in their whiteness. But still, I wouldn't judge them just because they're white, because they call me a racist. Judge them by their deeds, by their conscious behavior. And you know how they've been consciously behaving in the Congo, and how they consciously behave in Vietnam, and how they consciously behave right now in Alabama and Mississippi. So you and I got to get conscious and start behaving in a way that we can offset this thing before it's too late. And this is what they don't want to hear. One more thing concerning Tshombe. If you notice, and I must go all over there on the African continent in order to give you a better understanding of what's going on right here. The next thing that is good to know about Tshombe, no Congolese troops have ever won any victories whatsoever for the present Congolese government. Congolese soldiers won't even fight unless they're forced to. But the fighters in the Congo were the freedom fighters, these brothers from the Oriental Eastern province. And they fought with stones and sticks and rocks, spears and arrows. And the only time they had a gun was when they got some soldier who had it, and they'd kill him and take his gun. But they were winning. They took over two-thirds of the Congo, showing you they were fighting from their heart. Whereas these other people, their heart wasn't in it. And because of the fighting spirit of these people, it will be impossible for Tshombe to remain as head of state over the Congo without additional troops, white troops, constantly being brought in from South Africa or elsewhere. But sooner or later, these troops are going to give out, and then America is going to have to increase her troops like she did in South Vietnam, you know. She has, she's not at war over there, you know. They're only over there advising. They got about 20,000 advisors, you know, on the front line. But it's not a war. It's just they're in an advisory capacity while they insult the intelligence of their own public. And they're going to have to end up doing the same thing in the Congo. They'll be trapped. They'll have to eventually send American troops to occupy the Congo because the African freedom fighters are going to fight. They're not going to give up one inch without fighting back. And this is something that you should know, that they realize now on the African continent what's at stake and how much all of these Western powers have in common and what they're doing in cahoots with each other behind the closed doors. So on the African continent, they are training Africans to be soldiers so that they can invade each one of these countries and take it over and give it to their rightful people. One of the reasons, one of the last things I must say concerning the Congo, not only do they not intend for the Congo to fall into African hands because of its mineral wealth, and it has the greatest deposits of some of the richest elements or minerals of any other area on this earth. They don't intend to give it up because of its wealth. Another reason they don't intend to give it up, if you look at the map, you'll see that it is so strategically located geographically, wherein if a real, genuine African government were to come in power over the Congo, then it would be possible for African troops from all countries to invade Angola, which is a Portuguese possession, and if Angola fell, and it would fall, then it would only be a matter of time before Southwest Africa, Southern Rhodesia, and Botswana also would fall, and it would put African troops right on the border of South Africa. And that's where they really want to get, at that man down there in South Africa. And the United States interests are involved in blocking this. Yes, some of these liberals who grin in your face like they're your best friend, they got money tied up in the Congo. Some of the most powerful political figures in this country, some of them governors over states, got interest in the Congo, and got interest in South Africa, and got interest all over the African continent, and go there. And as the Africans awaken and realize this, it makes them filled with the incentive to never rest until that exploiter is driven out. So now, what effect does this have on us? Why should the black man in America concern himself? Since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years. Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in the negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of, an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity, our African characteristics. And you know yourself that we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long, dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't take a black man to do anything but play some horn, you know, some sounds, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. In serious things, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves, because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. And our hatred for ourselves stemmed from our hatred of things African. Along about 1955, they had the Bandung Conference in Indonesia. And at that time, the Africans, the Asians, the Arabs, all of the non-white people got together and agreed to de-emphasize their differences and emphasize what they had in common and form a working unity. And it was the working unity, the spirit of Bandung, created a working unity that made it possible for the Asians who were oppressed, the Africans who were oppressed, and others who were oppressed, to work together toward getting independence for these other people. And it was the spirit of Bandung that brought into existence this working unity that made it possible for nations that didn't have a chance to become independent, they did come into their independence. And most of this began along in 1959. And at 59, the spirit of African nationalism was a flame, was fanned to a high flame. And we then began to witness the complete collapse of colonialism. France began to get out of French West Africa. Belgium began to make moves to get out of the Congo. Britain began to make moves to get out of Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, Nigeria, and some of these other places. And although it looked like they were getting out, they pulled a trick that was colossal, in that when you're playing basketball and they get you trapped, you don't throw the ball away. You throw it to one of your teammates who's in the clear. And this is what the European powers did. They were trapped on the African continent. They couldn't stay there. They were looked upon as colonial imperialists. So they had to pass the ball to someone whose image was different. And they passed the ball to Uncle Sam. And he picked it up and has been running it for a touchdown ever since. He was in the clear. He was not looked upon as one who had colonized the African continent. But at that time, the Africans couldn't see that though the United States hadn't colonized the African continent, he had colonized 22 million blacks here on this continent, because we're just as thoroughly colonized as anybody else. When the ball was passed to the United States, it was passed at a time when John Kennedy came into power. He picked it up and helped to run it. Was one of the shrewdest backfield runners that history has ever recorded. He surrounded himself with intellectuals, highly educated, learned, and well-informed people. And their analysis told him that the government of America was confronted with a new problem. And this new problem stemmed from the fact that Africans were now awakened, they were enlightened, and they were fearless, they would fight. So This meant that the Western powers couldn't stay there by force, and since their own economies, the European economy and the American economy, was based upon their influence, continued influence over the African continent, they had to find some means of staying there. So they used the friendly approach. They switched from the old open colonial imperialistic approach to the benevolent approach. They come up with some benevolent colonialism, philanthropic colonialism, humanitarianism, or dollarism. Immediately, everything was Peace Corps, Crossroads. We got to help our African brothers. Pick up on that. Can't help us in Mississippi. Can't help us in Alabama or Detroit, out here in Dearborn, where some real Ku Klux Klan live. We're going to send all the way to Africa to help. I know Dearborn, you know. I'm from Detroit. I used to live out here in Inkster. And you had to go through Dearborn to get to Inkster. Just like riding through Mississippi when you got to Dearborn. Is it still that way? Well, you should straighten it up. So, realizing that it was necessary to come up with these new approaches, Kennedy did it. He won. He built, created an image of himself that was skillfully designed to make the people on the African continent think that he was Jesus, the great white father, come to make things right. And I'm telling you, some of these Negroes cried harder when he died than they cried for Jesus when he was crucified. From 1954 to 1964 was the era in which we witnessed the emergence, the emerging of Africa, and the impact that this had upon the civil rights struggle in America has never been told, fully told. For one reason, for one thing, one of the primary ingredients in the complete civil rights struggle was the Black Muslim movement. The Black Muslim movement, though it took no part in things political, civic, didn't take too much part in anything other than stopping people from doing this, drinking, smoking, and so on. Moral reform it had, but beyond that it did nothing. But it talked, such a strong talk, until it put the other Negro organizations on the spot. Before the Black Muslim movement came along, the NAACP was looked upon as radical. They were getting ready to investigate. And then along came the Muslim movement, and it frightened the white man so much, he began to say, thank God for old Uncle Roy and Uncle Whitney and Uncle A. Phillip. And Uncle, got a whole lot of uncles in there. I can't remember their names. They're all older than I, so I call them Uncle. Plus, if you use the word Uncle Tom nowadays, I heard they sue you for libel, you know. So I don't call any of them Uncle Tom anymore. I call them Uncle Roy.